around the room and check off your name. The other thing is for those of you who handed in your mini commentaries, they're marked and I forgot to bring them with me. So they will be in my pigeonhole in a folder no later than 1 o'clock tomorrow, when I have to be in anyway.
Any other mechanical questions?
Good. Let me quickly summarize. Last week, in which we examined the metaphysical exposition of space, it contains four arguments, two to demonstrate that space is a priori, and two to demonstrate that space is an intuition. The first argument that Kant uses says that space, knowledge of space must be a priori because it is presupposed as a condition for possibility for anything to be either outside our mind or for objects to be outside one another. And the twist in this argument, as suggested, is that the notion of outsideness, which he is taking here as primitive, that is, what is not in my mind, that's what I want, or some object independent of, outside another object, is not analytically equivalent to in space. That rather, it turns out for us human beings, the beings, the kind of beings we are, that we can only know an object to be outside our mind if it is somewhere where we are not, or where an object is somewhere where another object is not in space. So the is not, where I am not is where I am not spatially. So the first argument turns on demonstrating that there is a synthetic a priori relationship between the concepts of outside and spatiality. The second argument says that we can conceive of property. We can never represent to ourselves objects without space, but we can represent to ourselves space without objects. And I said that the temptation is to read this argument psychologically or even logically, but it's neither. The question is a question of, and it's important to remember throughout everything that's going to happen, that Kant, like Descartes and Hume and Leibniz, is a representationalist. He thinks that we have representations of the world. And the reason we can represent space as without objects is because when we do geometry, we are doing just that. That is, doing a geometrical proof of any kind just is a representation of the formal features of space. Hence, the entailment is, and what it adds to the first argument, is that not only is space necessary for our experience of objects outside us, but it is necessary for the possibility of the objects of outer experience, namely appearances. Kant then presents two arguments to show that space is an intuition, where the opposite of intuition now is a concept. And again, both these arguments about the a priori and about intuition are criticisms of Leibniz. Leibniz again thought that space was, couldn't be anything in itself. You can't touch it, you can't feel it, you can't kick it. Therefore, it was truly nothing. It represented, confusedly, relationships between objects, and that once we had deeper knowledge of objects, my theory that each monad was like a little computer program, then we wouldn't need the notion of space, that the identity of the object would be given by its computer program, by its complete concept. And that only monads were real, space was an illusion. Kant thinks space is an intuition, an individual, and his first argument for that is that the relation of part to whole of space, rather the relation of one to many with respect to space, is a part to whole. For anything to count as or to be a space is for it to be spatially related to some other space. So the right question about any representation of space is, where is it? And you can say it's to the left, to the right, above or below, 100 miles from, etc., from any other space, so that we get the parts of space are grasped, represented through their relationship to other spaces, and there's no point at which we could think of there being two spaces, because with respect to any possibility of two spaces, we would want to know, where is each space with respect to the other one? And the only thing that would count for us as knowledge of where would be a spatial account. So space must be one. The second argument for intuition is that concerns the idea of an infinite magnitude, and here the argument is that we always conceive of space such that for any given space there can be another space outside it. That we understand the idea that to imagine any, to represent any possible space, we would necessarily represent it as being bounded by some further space. And that further space, bounded again by a further space, etc. And that is the sense in which we have already an awareness of space as an infinite given magnitude. And then I presented a third argument for intuition, one that's not the critique of pure reason, namely the argument from incongruent counterparts, And I suggested that the envoy from incongruent counterparts, right hand, left hand, that these things are qua objects qualitatively identical. That is, if you did all the arguments about the relationship between my pinky and my thumb, all the analyses, it would come out that the angles, the measurements, exactly the same. And yet they're different. And I said that their difference is irreducible. That it is not therefore conceptually to be understood, that right and left first are spatial properties. And that secondly, that our knowledge is itself not conceptual. That is, there's no series of conceptual arguments or conceptual accountings which I can give you or anyone to tell you the difference between right or left. Rather, it is literally your, and the word that Kant used, and it turns out to be a word that's kind of irresistible, is that they are primitive orientations. The word orientation seems right. That our knowledge is intuitive in the sense that right and left are orientations, and thus our knowledge is immediate and non-conceptual. And hence, from those two arguments again, we can know that space now is an a priori intuition. That's where we left things last week. Those are five arguments you ought to know off the top of your head. But I say that with trepidation. Any questions about those five arguments before we try to draw some conclusions or some inferences from them for 2 hours? See what that's like. We're all happy with spaces and off the argument intuition. A bunch of 50 Kantians in the making. Well, the problem of space being an infinite given magnitude raises a slight problem about what Kant might mean by form of intuition. And indeed, it's something he comes to recognize himself. And therefore, he decides he wants to distinguish between the form of intuition and a formal intuition. And just so I don't have to say all this all the time, I will call the notion of space as a form of intuition space A, and space as a formal intuition space B. And why does he need this? Well, the idea of an intuition, to remind you of the definition, is the representation that is immediate and individual. It's an immediate representation of an individual. And you may say, what on earth would count as an immediate representation of an infinite given magnitude, right? It sounds like a bad moment in a Borges story. That we don't have, in other words, the idea of representing a one, which is what the idea is here, a space as a one, but we can't represent to ourselves immediately an infinity, right? So we have to kind of nuance this. So because roughly this notion, which is part of his argument for space being an intuition, simply is incompatible with the idea of its givenness. Infinity and givenness don't go together. So Kant will say later that in truth, space can only be represented by means of successive syntheses. That is, successive acts of representation in which I articulate and put together one representation with another representation. So I can successively synthesize this space, and then this space is outside it, and this space is outside it. But those are successive acts of synthesis. So Kant states at A291, that pure space and time are indeed something as forms of intuition, but are not themselves objects which are intuitive. There's a statement that can drive you crazy. Repeat the statement. They're something as forms of intuition, but are not themselves objects which are intuitive. Okay, well, in order to kind of get this going, this is what's driving this distinction between form of intuition and formal intuition. He says in a letter to Schulze, quoted by Allison, in page 95 in my edition, that this, the notion of form of intuition, is not an object itself, but the possibility of an object. Space as a form of intuition is not itself an object, but the possibility of an object. Therefore, it is a preconceptual, or we might want to say pre-intuitive, using Arthur Melnick's phrase, a pre-intuitive framework that both guides and limits conceptual activity. And space as a form of intuition is not itself an object, but a pre-intuitive framework that both guides and limits conceptual activity. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, here's what he wrote, rather what Schulze wrote to Kant. If I should draw a line from one point to another, I must already have a space in which I can draw it. And if I am to be able to continue drawing it as long as I wish, without end, then this space must already be given to me as an unlimited one. That is, as an infinite one. So, I start with the thought, have a space, two points. Obviously, I presuppose space and being able to draw this line. But I also think that I can kind of continue drawing this line and kind of continue on infinitely. Now, the thought that I can do that presupposes that space, so to speak, is in some sense there. That is, as guiding. In other words, why presuppose that? Because once I have a line, I've got a clear determinate space, right? So I can only presuppose that there is an indeterminate something guiding me, which makes me think that I continue drawing a straight line forever. Right? There's nothing that's going to stop me. So Schulze goes on to say, correlatively, I cannot successively generate any cylinder or body except in space. That is to say, I can only do so because this space is already given together with the quality which allows me to suppose the points are everywhere and which enables me to generate without end the three dimensions of extension. So the thought here, space as a form of intuition, and I'll try to explain how it constrains us in a moment. The question of constraint is very important here. But for the moment, space, a condition that makes possible space B. This is space B because this is a formal intuition. Right? This is just, right? I'm taking this to be a pure line in the geometrical sense. That is, if I am constructing a geometrical proof, I can perfectly well say, extend line AB infinitely. Possible step and a possible proof. Therefore, this is the formal intuition because it's built on activity, on a synthesis, on a constructive activity. I'm doing something, I'm making something appear that is itself determinate. Right? But the condition of possibility of that determinate space is space as a form of intuition. So we might say that while A is indeterminate, as form of intuition, B is determinate. Maybe that's just what geometrical activity is, making the indeterminate possibilities of space determinate. Kant makes this distinction explicitly in a footnote at B160, a footnote I'll have to return to when we do the second edition deduction. But we can look at the footnote itself now. paragraph 26 of the introduction. B160, the footnote at the bottom of the page. Space represented as an object, as we are required to do in geometry, that's what geometry is, the conception of space as an object. Why? Because it has determinate properties. Only objects have determinate properties, although in this case they're formal. Space, represented as object, contains more than mere form of intuition. It also contains combination of the manifold. I've connected point A and point B. So I've articulated the indeterminate manifold of space, right? Take two points, that's already a many. I've said the shortest distance between them is a straight line, therefore I've given them a determinate character. And it turns out that this is a necessary truth, by gum. Let's skip our Riemannian spaces for a moment. So, the manifold here, right, is just the two points in the line. And their connection would be, once we've constructed the object, the proof that shows that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and then you can do various things to prove that. It also contains combination of motion given according to the form of sensibility in an intuitive representation. So that the form of intuition gives only a manifold, which I'm calling the indeterminate potentiality for different geometrical figures, different possible spatial objects. The formal intuition gives a unity of representation. That is, I give space a determinate character. In the aesthetic, I treated this unity as belonging merely to sensibility, simply in order to emphasize that it precedes any concept, although as a matter of fact, it presupposes a synthesis which does not belong to the senses, but through which all concepts of space and time first become possible. For since by its means, space and time are first given as intuitions, unity of this a priori intuition belongs to space and time, and not to the concept of the understanding. What's the problem? I seem to hate that last bit.
No, it's not the last bit, but...
Oh, the middle bit.
No, it just, it bothers me that, what do we need concepts for then? If we have, you know, the unity already in the formal intuition.
No, formal intuition is conceptual in part.
Well, that's right, but, I mean, it is conceptual in part, but it's not, I mean... It's not yet introduced, you know. He hasn't talked about it yet in the book.
Right.
You're still on the sensation side.
Why do we need this? What do we need form of intuition? Yeah. Because it's a condition of possibility of this. That is, the conceptual determinations of space, right, are dependent. And that's what I have to show you. I'll show you that in a minute. I can show you that the conceptual determinations of space are dependent on the pre-intuition of the form of intuition. That is, let's call it on indeterminate spatiality as a condition of possibility. So you're absolutely right to ask the question, and what we want is some demonstration about what kind of constraint that is. Okay, having got that far, do you have a question about that? Just get some idea of what we're talking about. The next move Kant makes is in paragraph 3, And paragraph 3, the transcendental exposition of space, and he says a transcendental exposition, what does it allow us to do? He says the explanation of a concept as a principle in which the possibility of other a priori synthetic knowledge can be understood. So roughly, we have the idea thus far of space as an a priori intuition. Can that help us understand, let's do better, explain any other bits of knowledge we have? And he says, yes, the transcendental knowledge gives us a further explanation, namely, it explains the possibility of geometry, where he takes it as given that geometry is a body of synthetic a priori truths. That's a given. What he has to show is, from what we've already learned about space, space as itself an a priori intuition explains the possibility of geometrical knowledge. Okay. Well, first of all, why does Kant think that space is that geometry is a body of synthetic a priori truth? We talked about arithmetic on this handout. Do you have this one yet? Can you say? No, I can give that one out.
I got some money.
And there's some more floating around. They get hidden this top. And it's the second half of that diagram. Oops, we ran out. You can zero up some of the break. And it's the bottom half I'm interested in here, not the top half. Namely, the reason he thinks that geometry is a body of synthetic a priori truth is roughly because he thinks it just follows Euclid's method. That is, it's really textbook stuff. That is, it follows the proof structure of standard geometrical proofs as they were given by Euclid and his successors. And the crux of the matter is that there's a relationship in geometrical proofs between the discursive elements and the intuitive elements. So the first step, the protasis, is we're going to prove. And we state the proposition we want to prove. You know, two sides of a isosceles triangle equal to a third side, all that kind of stuff. Okay, how do you do that? Well, in standard Euclidean geometry, steps 2 and 3 set out the intuitive elements. He says, you know, let ABC be a triangle. So, you know, we get our ABC. And then you might say, extend line AB, you know, the same distance again, etc. You know, and then draw a line parallel to it, you know, and then you can do the distance of the boxes. And you'll, something like that, doesn't it? Something like that. But the point is the proof works through the construction. That the proof character is not a series of merely discursive propositions, but rather things we do with ideal figures. And this is the constructed element, the intuitive element, that then, using our constructions, we then make a series of claims, and we do a claim. So that Kant took it, and here's just the thought, that you can't do geometry with concepts alone. Right? You can't do it without drawing them damn pictures. Right? It's not merely deriving one concept from another concept, say you have just a couple of axioms, you know, two parallel lines never meet, shortest, you know, distance between points, a line's shortest distance between points. You can't pump out all of geometry just by a few axioms. Otherwise, it would be purely analytic. He thinks it extends our knowledge because it is bound up with these things. So just like I said about 7 plus 5 equals 12, varieties of ways in which he thinks that mathematics is not analytic. Yeah.
So what would Kant have to say about non-constructive proofs? So in the sense of, you know, proof by contradiction, right? Where what is to be proved is that something is not constructible, ergo, you can't assert the converse of the thing that you can show is not constructive.
But that depends on it. I mean, non-constructibility is exactly the sort of constraint he wants, right? As I'll show later, that's his absolute point. That to show that you know, what is the demonstration that two lines cannot enclose a space? Well, I as far as I'm aware, it's simply non-constructible, right? That's the point. It's not that, you know, there's no... So, the claim that any hexagon must contain a minimum of three sides is a principle of constructibility and not derivable from pure axioms. That is something we prove by what cannot be constructed. And that's what I mean, the question is perfect, by constraint. Right? What can and cannot be constructed is the demonstration of the constraint that the pre-intuition, the very question you were asking, right, why do we need it? It does the can construct. Okay, so now the question is, if you're convinced that geometry, and I know all of you have been thinking hard about geometry and nothing else. You haven't thought about it for years. Okay. Nonetheless, it's very beautiful, and it's deeply puzzling. And the puzzle is, how come it's so beautiful? How come it comes out like it does? How come we have this body of what seems utterly compelling proofs about the nature of space? Well, the transcendental position is going to argue that is because space is an a priori intuition, it makes possible synthetic a priori truths in geometry. That's the argument of paragraph 3. And a version of that argument is given by Van Cleve, the handout, the argument from geometry. One more. And we begin with exactly the issue you just mentioned, namely constructability. We begin with the idea we cannot construct any cubes with more than 8 corners, or any polygons without at least 3 sides. So we begin with the idea of a necessity. I'm going to be absolutely clear. Step one states a necessity, because the opposite of an impossibility is a necessity. From one, if we can't do it, we think, then there cannot be. That is, we think that if we cannot construct any cube with more than 8 corners, then there cannot be any cubes with more than 8 corners. Right? Otherwise, what's the point of our doing geometry at all? We construct this, we construct that, but of course there can be anything that's completely contradictory to what we do. That means that, no, I mean, if our idea here is that step one reveals a necessity, then that necessity must rule out contrary states of affairs. What do we make of that? Well, the thought is that the inference from 1 to 2, that is, from we cannot to there cannot be, must be legitimate otherwise there would be no accounting for our knowledge of geometrical truths such as 2. That is, geometrical truths don't state the folks hanging around 5th Avenue and 14th Street can't construct, you know, any cubes with 9 corners. It says there cannot be. That's geometrical knowledge, right? So, in a sense, the construction is meant to take us to an account of what is necessarily the case. So, in a sense, what's going on in step three, especially after the dash, is a kind of compressed transcendental argument. That is, argument that runs from the existence of some body of knowledge to its condition of possibility. How do I know there can't be? Because I cannot construct. And I cannot construct via, but, okay, so you just had your first little run-in with a transcendental argument. Let it be a foretaste of things to come. The thought here is from the existence of some knowledge to its condition of possibility. I know that there cannot be because I cannot construct. But the inference from 1 to 2 would be illegitimate if cubes were things themselves. That is, had their properties wholly independently of my powers of construction or conception. That is, whatever cubes were, you know, I'd have to what? I don't know. You know, stand up on it. You know, how do you find out how many goddamn corners a cube has? Well, if they're things themselves, I'm telling you, there's no way. You know, I mean, you know, you might... Maybe there's some crazy physicist who has some idea. There's no way. From that, it follows that cubes are not things in themselves. They're only appearances. Therefore, space is only an appearance and not a thing in itself, because geometrical proofs are nothing but proofs about the properties of space. But I'll bet you hate that argument. Feels like a sucker punch, doesn't it? Okay, well, let's see if we can refute the argument. Let's go to the next step. Any queries about the argument itself? Right? It's a beautiful argument. Yeah.
You've hinted at it a couple of times, but what about multiple geometries? Lobachevsky was like totally divergent geometries.
Right. I will come back to that in a second, but what roughly I want to say is, oh, let me do it now and just have done with it. I'm going to say that space is a form of intuition as indeterminate, that it becomes determinate, but it can be multiply determinate. That is, it doesn't determine which of one or more geometries is the case, but whichever one is, roughly, we can construct a variety of geometries, and then one of them turns out to be the geometry of space. So we'll just go through in the same way, just an extra step. You still need, the principle of constructibility will still hold, only turns out that the indeterminacy is stronger than Kant thought. And it's not even clear it's the same thought, because, by the way, there were non-Euclidean geometries in Kant's time. Right? We've had non-Euclidean geometries and proofs actually during Kant's lifetime. It was actually when the first proofs of non-Euclidean geometries were first emerging. So Kant knew about that and was unconcerned. Another issue is to say that whatever Kant's getting at here, it's equally true, and there are wonderful articles by Jim Hopkins and Honora O'Neill that are on your reading list, that perceptual space, the space as we perceive it, is blatantly non-Euclidean. Think about standing on a railroad track. Well, parallel lines that meet. Lo and behold. We live in non-Euclidean. I mean, of course, I'm not saying that. But the space as we perceive it is not Euclidean. Right? So whatever Kant means, again, it can't quite be the perceptual space that he's talking about. It's the condition of possibility of perceptual space is space, and that would be the space of physics. That's the series of arguments that's going to run. Yeah?
Could you say a little bit more about Kant's concept of magnitude? Because it strikes me that analytically I can show that there's an infinite magnitude between any two finite points, right?
Yeah.
So the notion of magnitude implicit in the concept of form of intuition has to be something different than some sort of transfinite understanding, right?
Well, no, he doesn't need that. I mean, he can see it both ways, because he's obviously capable of saying that any given space can be divided to infinity because of the notion of a point, right? That's fine. That for him is one side of the entailment that every element of space is a space. That's all. So he just needs it. He needs infinite magnitude to be extendable and divisible. That's all. He just needs those two ratios.
So there's nothing sort of lurking in the background of the notion of magnitude somewhere. Insofar as I can have a concept of magnitude that's purely spatial, right? So it's
right.
Sort of a delimitation of a particular region.
Right?
But I can also think about it in terms of cardinal relationships. So that one series of something that's infinitely large has a greater magnitude than something else that's infinitely large plus something else.
Right, but don't confuse geometrical planes with mathematical.
Well, this is sort of what I'm trying to find. I'm just wondering if there's...
No, I meant by infinite given magnitude a spatial magnitude. I'm sorry. Not a mathematical magnitude. And we have different arguments about arithmetic. Well, of course, the person who hated Kant most was Russell, right? Because Russell's whole life was spent trying to reduce mathematics and geometry to logic. And therefore, anything, you know, disturbed Russell, it was mathematical constructivism. And I won't go through the history of mathematical constructivism after Kant, although it's still a live option, and it's part of, for those who are interested, it's part of the kind of Wittgensteinian, Bemethian views about mathematics. That is, mathematics, something is true if and only if it is constructible or provable, is part of constructivist mathematics, which is not part of a logicist, it's an anti-logicist program. Skip that. It seems confusing. What's Russell's complaint? It's at the top of your third handout I gave you.
What one did he make it here? Are there more of them?
There are more of them. I don't seem to walk back here. And this is again from Van Cleve. This much of my argument is all Van Cleve, who I think is confused about all sorts of stuff, and I'll explain what he's confused about shortly. In fact, he's confused about just this stuff. But I'll explain why. So who wants to read just the top of page 38? Can somebody read out Russell's complaint? Read.
Apart from minor grounds on which Kant's philosophy may be criticized, there is one main objection which seems fatal to any attempt to deal with the problem of a priori knowledge by his method. The thing to be accounted for is our certainty that the facts must always conform to logic and arithmetic. To say that logic and arithmetic are contributed by us is not accounted for. Our nature is as much a fact of the existing world as anything, and there can be no certainty that it will remain constant. It might happen, if Kant is right, that tomorrow our nature would so change as to make 2 and 2 become 5. This possibility seems never to have occurred.
Do I want to try to suggest what Russell's worried about here? Stick to more for the moment. I'll come back.
Transcendental truths are still given through experience, and therefore they are also, they would encounter the same kinds of problems in a posteriori truth. They encounter the problem of induction.
That synthetic a priori truths are necessary truths, all right, but, and I won't go through all the stuff in modal logic, they are not necessary truths. Well, Kant seems aware of this thought. So the point is that I can show A, that space is a necessary condition of possibility, and B, I can show that the synthetic a priori character, the necessary character of geometrical truths, is dependent upon our powers of constructibility and space being an appearance only. But I can't explain any of that. So that's true is contingent. Kant says, A27, B43, I'm just interested at, it's really, it's just before A27 begins. It is therefore, this is Kant, solely from the human standpoint that we can speak of space, of extended things, etc. If we depart from the subjective condition, subjective condition, okay. Contingent condition. We can, he's acknowledging Russell here, I want to suggest. He's not arguing against that. He's agreeing that if we abstract from the subjective condition, under which alone we can have outer intuition, namely liability to be affected by objects, the representation of space stands for nothing whatsoever. This predicate can be ascribed to things only insofar as they appear to us, that is, only to objects of sensibility. The constant form of this receptivity, which we term sensibility, is a necessary condition of all relations in which objects can be intuited as outside, etc., etc. And again, at B1456, just so we're clear about what Kant thinks, Kant says, but in the above proof, there is one feature, I guess it's the beginning paragraph, from which I cannot abstract the feature, namely that the manifold to be intuited must be given prior to synthesis of the understanding and independently of it. How this takes place remains here undetermined. For were I to think an understanding which is itself intuitive, here's an example, the categories would have no meaning whatsoever in respect of such a mode of knowledge. They are merely rules for an understanding whose power consists in thought, consists, that is, in the act whereby it brings synthesis of the manifold given to it from elsewhere in intuition to the unity of apperception, the apperception just unity of myself. A faculty, therefore, which by itself knows nothing whatsoever, but merely combines. The peculiarity of our understanding, that it can produce a priori unity of perception solely by means of the categories, and only by such and so many, here's the giveaway sentence that I was looking for, is as little capable of further explanation as why we have just these and no other functions of judgment, or why space and time are the only possible forms of intuition. Why just these categories, why just space and time cannot be further explained. Now, the point here is that for Kant, the Russellian objection is exactly a form of bad transcendent realism. That it wants an explanation of everything, including an explanation of the human standpoint, from outside the human standpoint. That is, it refuses the contingency of the starting point, which is the idea of a human perspective, a human standpoint. When Kant suggests that we can only see or understand the world from within our own perspective, he's not suggesting this from some standpoint outside of us. He's trying, and this is why I'm going to say that the Copernican journey is a process, to tease us out of asking questions in which we attempt to step outside our own skin and observe ourselves from some standpoint that itself is not human. So of course, I want to say of course, everything that's necessary here is only contingently necessary. And that's given by Kant's leading question. Namely, the question, which is the Copernican turn again, what are the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience? The only notion of necessity is, let's call it functional necessity. Necessity for the possibility of experience, but nothing outside that. So he begins with the constraint of experience and simply said the best we can do, and a lot of people think we can't even do that, right? We can come back to that whole argument. Now, whether it's possible. Right? One of the arguments against Husserl is that okay, right? This is Heidegger's critique of Husserl. Because even that's too much. But at least Kant thinks the question, what are the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience? The notion of necessity is already connected to a contingency, that we have experience that we do. What are its conditions of possibility? So, of course, and now I'll say why Van Cleve is confused. Of course, it does not follow from something that is necessary in Kant that it is necessarily necessary. That is, it fails one of the principles of S5, one of the forms of modal logic. But we shouldn't be the least bit concerned about that, because modal logics are precisely logics of possible worlds independently of any constraint about what's knowable. Right? So even talking about questions of Kantian necessity by using the tools of modal logic is a mistake. You cannot comprehend the character of Kant's modal vocabulary through modal logic. And of course, I don't want to ruin anybody's career, say cryptes, but as far as I'm concerned, all of modal logic simply rests on a mistake. Yeah?
I want to know, I mean, how do you deal with the claim that, it seems to me, with this one claim here, is that we can't know if tomorrow what Kant has to say, for example, about space will still hold, and that seems to be still letting carrying over the problem Hume had. And this is precisely, I mean, a major problem that Kant thinks that he's solving. And so what, if we say that this is there's a contingency underlying necessity, then how do we solve the question of whether we can know something, just know it in a way that will allow us to predict, you know, what will be the case tomorrow?
Well, the answer is going to be that again, I'm going to have to show, what I have to show is that the question is ill-formed. That you think you have a good question, but you don't. We'll have to get there when we get to the causal vocabulary. But again, I want to say that question, how do I know? Well, let me just do it at this level. How do I know that all of this won't change tomorrow is actually a question that abstracts from possible knowledge. So the whole idea of the Copernican turn is it's meant to give us a framework of what it means to think imminently and not transcendently. That is what it means to think from within a human framework. And the question of how do I know that these necessary truths will be necessary tomorrow, I want to say, is asked if it's cashed out. Can it only be the question of how do I know that these necessary truths are necessary? Right? But that again is denying the opening gambit. Which is why, and I'll say more about later, a great deal of what Kant has to say in what he calls the second half of the whole second half of the book, The Dialectic, is a therapy. I mean by that that Kant thinks that it is inevitable, necessary, given who we are, that we are going to ask transcending questions. And indeed, he's going to demonstrate why we ask, the necessity of our asking, bad questions. So that we go wrong philosophically. Kant, by the way, I think was the first philosopher to do that. He wants to show that part of the whole strategy of the critique is to show why not only has everyone before him been wrong, every philosopher thinks that, but he wants to ground their activities as, let's call them, intrinsic temptations of human reason. So he thinks the temptation to try to think in a non-finite way, to try to have an infinite perspective, is both inevitable and wrong. And we're going to have to, as it were, therapeutically, which is why I keep saying that the Copernican turn is a movement, something you learn or undergo by a series of steps, by saying, oh, I've been tempted. Okay. And indeed, I think that is exactly what goes wrong with Moore's question. Moore, the second little quote, it never seems to have occurred to Kant to ask how we can know that all men's minds are so constituted as always to act in a certain way. And roughly, what Moore's question does, like Russell's question, I think they both have the same status, is that both of them blame Kant for not ontologically or metaphysically explaining the possibility of synthetic a priori knowledge, rather than saying it merely functions as a condition of possibility or experience. That is, I think that the question here simply is another version of ignoring the finitude of knowledge. I mean, all these questions, these objections, I think ignore the finitude of knowledge. And ignore the idea that there's an ultimate frame that this is always for us. The necessary conditions of possibility for us. And you want to know, well, yeah, but is it really true? I mean, yeah, I know it's just for us, but really? And we're going to see this keeps coming back over and over and over again. It's the constant, even Kantians, like Van Cleve and Paul Dwyer, don't get it. That they can't resist asking the wrong question. And that's because being finite about knowledge is really hard. A couple questions, yeah.
Can I just a more sympathetic reading of Russell and Moore's objection? Wouldn't you just say that, you know, the Kantian approach is just viciously circular? You know? So how do I know...
It can be viciously circular.
Well, I mean, in the sense that the conditions for the possibility of experience explain any given experience, but those conditions themselves are somehow abstracted out of any given experience that I've got. So you move from given experience, the conditions of possibility of experience, back to the given experience, right? So, I mean, they seem to, you know, go without mediation from one to the other, it seems, right? So, I mean...
Well, they go through mediation because... And the mediation is interesting. It's... the secret word that gives Kant all his leverage is possible. What are the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience? That is, he's not trying to explain actual experience. He wants something much weaker than actual experience, namely the necessary conditions for possible experience on the assumption that the notion of possibility is the fourth. That there has to be a way of giving some non-trivial character to the demonstration. So, of course, the conditions for my experience of seeing the blue cap turn out to be, you know, the guy with the blue cap and the guy who made it, blah, 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 and then you're going to get viciously circular. You're just going to repeat everything. So he thinks that there's something interesting might be found by going up to the notion of possibility. So it's the notion of, and he thinks that, why? Because we've got to what? Have some leverage toward, if we're conceptual creatures, toward our modal vocabulary. That is, we better have a leverage toward necessity. And our leverage towards necessity is going to be gotten through the impossible. So by asking about the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience, and as we'll see towards the end, turns out the necessary conditions for possibility of experience are way too weak for actual experience, which is essentially what the third critique is all about. The possible experience turns out to be a wild underdetermination. So it's not circular, because it's thinking that the possibility of experience, right, is an horizon. Right? That the notion of the possible here is, so possible here is instead of logically possible. So Kant substitutes possible experience for logical possibility, which is the constraint of logic. So what he asks is there a form of rational constraint, one that will allow us to argue, that is more constraining than logical possibility? And he argues the next weakest form of constraint is epistemic possibility. Which is, for example, blatantly weaker than causal possibility, for example.
I guess I'll have to wait to see how he distinguishes epistemic possibility from logical possibility. Because, I mean, it strikes me that one could plausibly conceive of epistemic plausibility and possibility coinciding with what is logically possible.
No, it's got to be the stronger constraint. There are many more things that are logically possible than are possible to know. That's a gimme, right? That's easy, right? So that the possible experience is a mere small subset of logically possible worlds. So they can coincide. And that's why I'm saying that if that's right, and modal operators operate here, necessity, possibility, blah, 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 then modal logic ain't going to help us. Therefore, the axiom of, you know, necessarily P entails necessarily P is going to fail the possible experience. More than you wanted to know. Okay, let me stop there. Let's break with this and have a little 5-minute break, and then we'll turn to the hefty bit, the idealism stuff.